A man had a wife and a daughter. He worked long and hard at his job and never failed to give them all they wanted and needed materially. The girl's room was full of expensive toys, and she wore the latest fashionable clothes. One evening, he happened to visit his daughter in her room and was puzzled to see the array of expensive toys languishing at the back of the room. Next to the girl's bed, at eye level, was a scrap of paper, a handwritten note, pinned to the wall. The man recognized his own handwriting. It was a note he had hurriedly written because he couldn't attend her birthday party. It read, "My apologies, love, Dad." The expensive gift of jewelry he had left with the note was nowhere to be seen. "Why," he asked his daughter, "is this worthless piece of paper hanging on the wall?" "Because," his daughter replied, "it's the only thing I have that is really from you." The most sacred of Lakota spiritual practices is the Wiwang Wachipi, or the looking at the sun and dancing, more popularly known as the sun dance. For non-Indians, it is probably the most intriguing and the most misunderstood. Most non-Indians are appalled or turned off by what they describe as self-torture, the skin piercing that some participants must endure. The piercing is done to male dancers who have pledged to perform the dance. The skin of the upper chest, the pectoral region, is pierced in two places and skewers made of bones are inserted. To the skewers is attached a cord that is tied to a central pole. The participants pull the cord tight as they dance, the object being to tear the skewers through the flesh. Other participants may be skewered through the skin on their backs, and they pull several buffalo skulls as they dance. The United States government, at the urging of many Christian churches that characterized the dances as uncivilized and barbaric, outlawed the sun dance. They failed or chose not to see the ceremony for what it was, a symbolic act of sacrifice. The sun dance is still with us because it demonstrates to us that sacrifice must be a genuine an operative virtue in our culture. The sun dancer gives of himself, in spite of the terrible pain of being pierced and having skewers tear through his flesh. One obviously doesn't endure such pain for frivolous reasons. Participation may be an act of thanksgiving, for example, but it is always real and symbolic and reminds us that sacrifice, no matter how painful, is often necessary. To perform the sun dance is to truly give or offer the one gift that is most meaningful, the gift of self, which is all any of us truly has to give. I can recall my grandmother doing laundry for my uncle when he was in college. She would be the first to say that it was all part of her job. My uncle was at the University of South Dakota, some 250 miles away. He sent his laundry home by parcel post in a suitcase, and Grandma would wash it by hand in a galvanized tub with a washboard, hang everything up to dry on the outdoor line, and then do the ironing. If the wind and the sun cooperated, it was a day's chore. I can remember her ironing those white shirts by lamplight late at night. She would meticulously fold them and repack them in a suitcase, which then meant that Grandpa and I would haul the suitcase by a team and wagon to the rural mailbox on the highway. As I recall, this happened on a regular bi-weekly schedule. I know without a doubt that my uncle appreciated those efforts because there weren't many laundromats on campus in those days. Sending the laundry home proved to be a labor-intensive process because we had no electricity in the late 1940s. Water had to be heated on the wood stove, and the laundry hung on an outdoor line and then taken down, and the heavy iron heated on the stove. I'll always have this point of reference for the phrase, doing the laundry. My grandparents made plenty of sacrifices for me as well. For reasons that are still not clear to me, I must have changed schools at least a dozen times before I graduated from high school. My grandparents moved to be near me a few times. More than a few times, my grandmother did my laundry, sewed on buttons, darned socks, and so on. I appreciated those chores she did, but I know she thought of them as nothing more than little labors of love within a job description of a grandmother. There were hundreds of those little chores, perhaps thousands, that she performed for me and my siblings. I still appreciate them not because of a patch on a pair of trousers or a freshly ironed shirt, but because of the lesson that came with them. She taught me how to give of myself. Sacrifices come in all sizes and for every reason under the sun. And there are times when we can be unaware that someone has made one for us or because of us. Tough and extraordinary circumstances will always bring extraordinary individuals to the top with their acts of selfless courage and sacrifice. History has its crazy horses, spotted tails, and buffalo calf roads. We will never forget their deeds or their sacrifices. Ordinary, everyday people also make sacrifices and remind us that it is within human nature to do so. We stand and offer our seats on the bus or on the subway, or we step back to let someone ahead of us in line. We help the elderly travelers nearest in line carry their bags to the ticket counter. A mom does without new clothes so she can buy them for her children. A man checks on his vacationing neighbor's house and waters and mows the lawn. These are simple acts, but they can give us all a sense of dignity and an example to follow. My cousin Israel Knife and I were deer hunting near the confluence of the Little and Big White Rivers in the fall of 1964. Israel was extremely shy around white folks. In fact, he would always ask me to order for him in restaurants. But by ourselves in the backcountry, or anywhere white folks went around, he could talk my ear off. We didn't have much luck on this particular day, so we wearily trudged back to a trail where our ride, Israel's dad, would pick us up. Just west of the Little White River, we heard a commotion in some trees, a veritable tirade of cussing and shouting. Soon we found the source of the noise, two out-of-state white hunters who had managed somehow to entangle the antlers of a 5-point white-tailed buck in the strands of an unyielding 3-strand barbed wire fence. With the antlers caught, the dead deer wasn't going anywhere, no matter how the two hunters tried to disentangle it. In fact, they did nothing but exacerbate the situation. They were twisting the antlers tighter into the wire. Having exhausted all alternatives from their point of view, the hunter's next recourse was to cut off the head and leave it caught in a fence. As they each whipped out a Bowie knife with a 12-inch blade, I suggested that a game warden might take a dim view of a headless deer carcass. Israel and I studied the puzzle of the tangled antlers. We inserted sturdy twigs at a few strategic places, untwisted the wire, and freed the antlers. The deer fell to the ground, and I swear he looked quite relieved. Then we carefully dragged the carcass under the bottom strand and turned it over to the two astonished hunters. "How did you do that?" asked one. "Why did you do that?" asked the other. "Somebody had to," replied Israel. It was the first time I ever heard him use a disgusted and at the same time amused tone of voice to a white man. They offered us money, which we declined. We walked away, and when we turned to look back, they were still staring at us, their jaws hanging open. "Money would have been nice," I said. "Yes," replied Israel. "But just think, every time those two go deer hunting or see a deer, they're going to think about two Indian boys." Amazing what the gift of self can do.